Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. Here we feature the best of our conversations with politicians, authors, and commentators. And you can listen to Press Review, our show picking the stories that caught the attention of our team. This week, I spoke to Rory Stewart on YouTube. He's a former MP and cabinet minister, now lecturing at Yale. I wanted to talk to him about the Afghan humanitarian crisis. We began by talking about the sleaze scandal engulfing Westminster. Today, I'm talking to Rory Stewart about Afghanistan, the situation on the ground there, and what he thinks needs doing to avert a humanitarian disaster. Rory was an MP, of course, and a minister, and is now senior fellow at the Jackson Institute, Yale University. Joins us from the US. Welcome, Rory.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the first question, before we get on to Afghanistan, I just had a question about the situation over here at the moment with MPs. You'll have seen from the other side of the Atlantic what's happening. The inquiry into Owen Paterson, furious Commons debates, lots of demands for change and reform. You were an MP and then you left. What do you make of it? I mean, the Brits say they want better politicians. Is that possible? How do they get them?
I think one of the things, I mean, there are many things that are pretty dismal about this. And I don't want to come across as some pompous sex MP making moral judgments. But at the heart of it is problems with our constitution, with the rules and respecting the rules. So, you know, what was going wrong last week? It wasn't just that Owen Paterson had been found guilty by a committee, but it was that Parliament was somehow trying to overturn that committee. So there doesn't seem to be any real sense in Parliament about what it can and can't do. And that's particularly worrying because what you end up with is a weird world in which the Prime Minister and the whips are forcing people to do bizarre things. That's included, going back in time, things like the prorogation of Parliament, dissolving Parliament to try to get a particular vision of Brexit through in 2019. I find all this really troubling because if you think about those MPs, most of them would not have wanted probably to vote to abolish that committee. But there's a horrible kind of tribal pressure. People feel awkward about disagreeing with each other. They're forced to do things that make them probably feel a bit sick. And it's this horrible sort of sense of fake loyalty. In other words, the great word loyalty being used to force people to do things that they feel queasy about. And I think somewhere also at the bottom of it, something that makes me very sad, which is presumably some of these people are beginning to think, did we really sign up for this man to be prime minister? He's increasingly doing things which we disapprove of and we don't feel proud of and we're not happy facing up and sitting, but we're loyally tromping through the lobbies doing that. And what's the solution to this? I think the solution has to be rediscovering a sense of some sort of values. We need, in a very simple way, people to say, no, that's not how we do things. We're not going to behave in this way.
You think, is there something structurally wrong with the parties? Because, of course, the parties are the gatekeepers, the two major parties thinking of principally, in terms of control over selection. So they're the filter through which people pass. I've been thinking a lot about this recently. I would have, until fairly recently, taken a very traditionalist view, which was that people should go into politics at a relatively early age. Most of the greats started out very young, actually, and took the view that it would take them a while to get to cabinet. They might get fired along the way. They'd go through two or three iterations and then be ready to be foreign secretary or prime minister. You think of Pitt the Younger. Obviously, you think of Disraeli, Gladstone, Lloyd George, Churchill, Thatcher. These are all people who went into politics relatively young. So that's how I saw it. And thought that the benefit of that was that it was a training ground. At moments of crisis, it gave you the possibility of greatness appearing. I'm not so sure that that's true anymore in terms of how life works, the number of career changes people have. You've done it yourself. And I'm starting to think maybe people need to do other things and maybe hop in and out of politics, maybe do it for 10 years or do it at, right at the end of a career when they don't need the money. They may have earned their money in law or one of the professional services. What do you think?
Well, I think that it's a very interesting question. A lot of things to unpack there. One of them is that one of the strange things about Britain is that, like you, I and many other people tend to imagine there's a whole continuum going all the way back to Pitt the Younger. But of course, the truth is that all those people that you talked about, except for Mrs. Thatcher, really came in 18th, 19th century politics. They were wealthy people with private incomes. And yes, they came in young, but they didn't come in by stuffing envelopes and campaigning on streets. They weren't hardworking local councillors. They weren't special advisors. They didn't go through the whole strange mill, which is really designed as a sort of hazing ritual now. Since the 1950s, getting into politics has been a sort of hazing ritual where you have to humiliate yourself for 5, 10, 15 years, standing in unwinnable seats, endlessly campaigning on local councils. And it creates a particular type of personality because what it prioritizes above all is loyalty, your ability to really take the crap, be humiliated again and again and again, month in, month out. I mean, the reason why, presumably, you didn't become a member of parliament, many other people don't become one, because they simply don't have the stamina to give up 10 years of their life generally before they can ever enter parliament. Spending every weekend and every evening out there delivering those leaflets and making friends with the 200, 300 members of their local constituency association, mostly elderly, to do. And that produces a very odd sort of person. What it means is that by the time they enter parliament, most of their idealism has already been knocked out of them, right? Most of their vision of public service has gone. They've been trained to see it as about loyalty and about a war with another political party, because that's what you're really doing with delivering those leaflets and campaigning. So we select people who are great street campaigners, and then we expect them to be great cabinet ministers. And it doesn't really work because the mindset of the great street campaigner is not really about critical thinking, it's not really about reading widely, it's not really about thinking boldly. It's about loyalty and party political games. So most of the cabinet are surprisingly cynical. I mean, I feel this coming from the United States. I'm talking to the United States. American politicians are oddly, feel to me at least, much more idealistic now than British politicians. Genuinely much more interested in ideas. They may not be formally as bright. They may not have gone to the best schools, the best universities, but there is a culture of really caring. You know, I talk to the local congressperson here, and they want to spend 2 hours talking about the details of what's happening in Afghanistan. That's very rare now in British politics. British politics, for years now, it's been a sort of game where people calculate, that's not worth 2 hours of my time worrying about the details of what's happening in Afghanistan. What do the opinion polls tell me? Is that going to get votes? How's that going to harm the opposition? Now, forget it. I'll have a line. You know, we're going to support the troops, or we're going to do what we can to get refugees. I don't want to know the details of that stuff. And that goes to the depths of everything. I felt in the tea rooms, almost impossible, you would have found this, you deal with politicians, quite difficult to have an earnest policy conversation because the tone is very, very sort of light-hearted, very sort of cynical. It's gossipy. It's not a serious culture. We don't really ask ourselves, is this person fit to be the Secretary of State in this particular department? It's a game of a promotion.
So quick question just before we go on to Afghanistan. I mean, would you ever go back? You're in the US now, but would you ever go back into full-time UK politics?
Well, I think about it all the time. I mean, I thought about possibly standing in Owen Paterson's seat as an independent. But it is such a strange world, such a strange culture. I mean, it's very, very difficult to communicate to somebody who's not in it how depressing it is day in, day out, unless you really love the sort of daily game of jeering in the House of Commons and who's up and who's down. It's a much more depressing career than any other thing I've seen, compared to the army or the foreign office or academia or journalism, where you're generally surrounded by people who have a sense of common culture, common values, common loyalty, and who don't treat things as though it's a game. Too many people in politics, sadly, don't want to have serious, responsible conversations. They want to. It's a depressing culture, and I would have been so depressed being asked on a three-line whip last week to vote for Owen Paterson. Sorry, not vote for Owen Paterson, vote to abolish a parliamentary committee. I mean, it's unimaginably depressing because either you are loyal to your party, in which case you feel bad about yourself, or you try to retain your integrity, in which case you've blown up all your relationships, your colleagues. I mean, it's a really toxic environment. So the answer is yes, I'm often tempted, but the truth is I'm also very, very aware after 10 years in politics just what a very strange and miserable world it is.
Speaking of serious and responsible conversations, let's talk about Afghanistan. Now, describe just what's the situation now on the ground? You're in the US, but you've obviously got a lot of links there. You know it well. What is the situation on the ground?
Well, it's horrible. I mean, I was in Afghanistan the end of last year, and it was already pretty bad then. COVID had struck Afghanistan very hard, but since then it's got much worse. Obviously, the Taliban has taken over, which is horrifying in terms of, to put it in grand terms, political and civil rights. But basically, if you are somebody who's been a critic of the Taliban, if you are from the Shia minority in central Afghanistan, many ways, if you're a woman, right, life has got much worse. But also, there's a drought. And compounding that, Britain, the United States, Europe have essentially suspended almost all their development and humanitarian aid. They've announced big numbers. So the British government's announced well over £200 million. But there's no serious plan on how to deploy that money. That money isn't being spent. What you've got is Afghans who are now very short of food and will soon be starving to death. Some are already starving to death. A lot of nonprofits and charities on the ground and UN agencies who have staff who could be doing things who are simply not receiving the support to do them. Because for some good reasons and some bad reasons, the international community has basically turned its back on Afghanistan.
And what needs to happen now, do you think?
Well, essentially, we need to understand that starving the Afghan people or threatening to starve the Afghan people in the belief that that's somehow going to change the behavior of the Taliban is cruel, it's immoral, and it's completely unworkable. We know this. We know this from the generals in Myanmar. We know this from the guys that run South Sudan, that threatening to starve populations doesn't change the behavior of governments. All it does is lead to untold misery. There is definitely a way of getting support through the Afghan people without giving it to the Taliban government. That's what these UN agencies and charities exist to do. I run a small charity on the ground. There are much bigger charities like Save the Children who can do this stuff, right? We're all ready to do things. But we're tied up. We're tied up in crazy bureaucratic rules. We're tied up in silly anxieties around legal requirements. So, for example, there are 1 million Afghan women who work in the carpet industry. We could be selling their carpets around the world, but nobody feels confident doing that because we aren't confident on legal advice on paying export tax. And that's just a tiny example, but you can repeat it 100 times there.
And how should we think about the Taliban now? I mean, this is really, really difficult in the West, isn't it? Considering the amount of sacrifice, worse for the Afghans, but the sacrifices that were made by Western powers, lives lost, and the Taliban was, of course, the enemy. The intervention in 2001 was designed to remove the Taliban. They're now in power. Do you advocate just being, do you just have to be, does the West just have to be completely pragmatic about that and forget it?
Well, I think there are two things. I mean, the first is we need to honor 20 years of relationships between ourselves and Afghans. Nearly 2 million Americans, Brits, and others served in Afghanistan in different capacities over that 20-year period. We have friendships, we have relationships, and there are 37 million people living in Afghanistan. They didn't vote for the Taliban. In many ways, we abandoned them for the Taliban. One of the reasons the Afghan army collapsed so quickly is essentially we dismantled their entire air force as the Taliban was advancing and did nothing really to support them.
And that was by removing technical support and
Yeah,
know-how on computers
exactly.
and all that sort of thing.
Essentially, they couldn't get those planes off the ground because they depended. It's a completely crazy idea. We designed an air force that required 18,000 foreign civilian contractors to operate those planes, and we took those contractors out. So they couldn't get the software updates, they couldn't fly. And so you had little platoons of Afghan soldiers who were getting no resupply. They couldn't get their ammunition, they couldn't get their food, they couldn't get their medical evacuation. So they had fought very bravely against the Taliban for nearly 20 years, but ultimately their morale broke. And the thing that broke it was the sense that there was no one holding their back, and in particular that they were going to have no escort. So we bear some responsibility for this. But above all, we must understand that it isn't that the Afghan people somehow chose the Taliban. Right? I'm getting people saying, well, we can't give them any money. If the Afghan people chose the Taliban, it's up to them. They're on their own. But they didn't choose the Taliban. If you're a female teacher in Kabul, you are horrified by what's happened. You want to leave the country, right? You're on the edge of starvation, and this brutal government's taken over. So we need to separate, obviously, this government, which has taken power by force, largely, or to a very large extent, because of what we did, from the interests of the Afghan people. And we need to honor our relationship with the Afghan people, and we need to do what we can to support them. And remember that, put it in context, we do that for many people around the world. I don't mean Britain alone, I mean the international community does it for people in a humanitarian crisis in sub-Saharan Africa as well.
Now, where's China in all of this? Because, of course, China is now, as once the West vacated the scene, the Americans left, and into that vacuum, China, which obviously has security interests in the area and a particular relationship with Pakistan, China's there. What's it trying to achieve? And I mean, China's not a country which necessarily likes being on the spot in that way and being responsible in the way that the Americans do or did take responsibility.
And you're completely right. China does not want to nation build in Afghanistan. They don't want to carry the development weight of Afghanistan. The world is a very odd place. And one of the odd things about it is that essentially, when we talk about the international community, we really mean America, Europe, Canada, Australia. Countries like China are getting wealthier and wealthier, but they are not international players in that way. And they're not going to be. And it, you're, I mean, people are quite right to say it seems a bit unjust that these wealthy countries are not carrying their weight, but they don't want to, and they're not going to. We have a choice between either a disaster, starvation, horror, with the Chinese playing potentially some developing political relationships with the Taliban government, but they're not going to step in and support the state because that's not how they do things. And so if we wish people to avoid starvation, we have reasons to do that because we don't want more instability, more terrorism, more horror in Afghanistan. It is for countries like Britain and Europe and the United States to step in, as it has been really since the Second World War. But the sad thing is that we're losing confidence, we're losing energy. And one of the signs that we're losing confidence and energy as, in inverted commas, the West, is that we're increasingly inclined to say, well, you know, why aren't the Chinese doing more? Why aren't the Pakistanis doing more? Why aren't the Indians doing more? But, well, a good question, but that's the way the world is. And either we want to stand up for our values, which include looking after people in horror, in poverty, and also, I would say, stand up for values which include democracy. I'd like to see Britain lead a coalition trying to get democratic states to step up, for example, and take a share, fair burden share of Afghan refugees.
So you have just preempted my last question, but I was going to ask you, what are the longer term risks of this going wrong? Firstly, in humanitarian terms, and then secondly, in terms of security, the security sphere.
So in absolutely straightforward terms, as Afghanistan collapses into becoming one of the poorest countries on earth, and we'll end up back in the situation that I saw when I walked across Afghanistan 20 years ago. I walked across Afghanistan just the end of the Taliban period, and one in five children were dying before the age of five. Adult life expectancy was about 37, and there was just no services across the entire country. It literally, in central Afghanistan, very, very difficult to see any difference between a village in central Afghanistan in 2001 and what it would have been like in the early Middle Ages, right? No electricity, no healthcare, no government, nothing, right? and we're about to go back to them. What does that mean? That means that there will be instability, there will be starvation, there will be many, many Afghans trying to leave the country as migrants or refugees. And the Taliban government will struggle to hold control. ISIS Khorasan, which is already set off 54 bomb attacks in the last few weeks in Afghanistan alone, will start mounting more and more terrorist attacks in Afghanistan and out of Afghanistan. ISIS is an international jihadi group. Instability will spread to places like Pakistan. So that's a dangerous situation. But there's a bigger story, which is about the West, about liberal values, about democracy, about things that I care about, you care about, and the world used to care about. And one of the strange things about the way in which President Biden has responded to this is he seems to have forgotten that part of the picture. Afghanistan, for all its troubles, had many troubles. It was corrupt, it was fragile, but it was a democratically elected government. And it is now run by an unelected, brutal, jihadi theocracy. And we need to think more positively about how Afghanistan in 15, 20 years' time could be slightly more prosperous, slightly more democratic, slightly more pro-Western than it is today. But our only path to get there is to provide generous humanitarian development support, not to the Taliban government, but to the Afghan people, because if we don't do that, if we betray them at this moment, we guarantee all our nightmares will happen.
Rory Stewart there. Next, Press Review, a special edition with Tim Marshall, geopolitics expert, author, and reaction columnist. Welcome to Press Review, the show from Reaction, where the Reaction editors and star columnists pick the stories that have grabbed us in the last 7 days or so and discuss them. It's a special edition today, I'm delighted to say, because I'm joined by my colleague, the great Tim Marshall, author, expert on geopolitics, and we're going to have a spin through the stories which really caught our attention in the last few days. The first thing I wanted to highlight actually was your piece this morning, Tim, for Reaction on Bosnia, where there's trouble brewing.
There is. It's been simmering for a while. It hasn't boiled over, but the heat's being turned up, if you want to continue the analogy. I mean, I'm an old, one of those old hacks that said, oh, yes, when I was in Bosnia in the 1990s. And that generation of foreign correspondents, have never really let go of that. We've always kept a weather eye on it. And it's gone through some difficult times, Bosnia. And the Dayton Accords of 95, most people agreed, only froze the conflict. They didn't create the architecture to solve the underlying tensions in the conflict. And so those tensions are still there. And then this summer, there's a number of things happened. Over the past few years, President Putin in Russia, who is a big supporter of Republika Srpska, that's the Serb part of the divide in Bosnia. He's given at least 4,000 assault rifles to the Bosnian Serb police and some other heavy weapons that a police force doesn't really need. So what's going on there? Milorad Dodik is the president of the Republika Srpska part of Bosnia. And he appears to be creating a quasi-military police force. That's always been worth keeping an eye on. And then in the last couple of weeks, he suddenly said that by the end of this month, and it could be a bluff, he will create a Bosnian Serb army. Now, that is against the Dayton Accords. He further says that therefore the Bosnian army barracks, the Bosnian army is about 10,000 men and women, and they're made up of the three different communities of Bosnia. Well, the barracks of the national army that are in the Bosnian Serb area, Republika Srpska, he said they would have to clear out. And of course, my new army will go in. They could not let that slip. The Bosnian army would have to say no. So would the EU, sorry, the High Representative, at which point that spark could cause guns to be fired. And that's why it's worth keeping an eye on. I mean, there's a lot more to it, obviously, there always is than that. But that was what really caught my attention. And I just wanted to write about it. Because I do think the alarm bells are ringing. I don't want to be a Cassandra. I don't want to say the Bosnia War is about to break out again. I'm not making that argument. I'm making the argument that it is more tense now than it has been for some time. And that if this threat is carried out, it's difficult to see how there wouldn't be some form of violence that would break out.
Yeah, and it's as you said in the piece, if you're a member of Reaction, you can read that piece. If you're not a member of Reaction, go to the link below and you can become a member. You get Tim's column, you get my weekly newsletter, all sorts of other stuff from the Reaction team. And you said in that piece that that the EU, the Europeans, the Brits should think about sending some troops. Of course, Of course, there are. I've written about this. It's not just Bosnia in isolation, is it?
No.
This is
no.
The big story behind this is what Putin is up to, and we're going to come on to talk about stories on Ukraine and Belarus. In fact, let's go to the Ukraine first. And there's a splash in the Telegraph on Friday morning, which is essentially the US warning, the Telegraph out of London reports, warning the Europeans, the EU, that that Putin might be about to invade Ukraine, whether that means full invasion or just take more, do I say just, but take more territory. They think that this, unlike previous occasions where tensions have been rising, that something might be about to happen. What did you make of it, Tim?
On the journalistic sort of press review side of it, it's a bold move by the Telegraph to splash it on the front page, because most people know about the story. The Americans have warned, and there's been a flurry of diplomatic activity. Kamala Harris was warning Macron about it when she was in Paris last week. Biden's briefed the EU commissioner about president, sorry, about it, et cetera, all sorts of briefings have been going on. But of course, we have been there before. Putin has marched his troops to the top of the hill and then he's marched them down again, not because of any threat, just because he was poking and prodding. Mm-hmm. So it's bold by the Telegraph to splash on it, because he might be doing that again. On the other hand, there are reasons to think this is a little bit different. And there are many reasons. One is really hard to quantify, and that is that after Afghanistan, I think many of us have been waiting for where Russia will test the resolve, notably of the Americans, because I think we know that the EU doesn't have much resolve in these matters. The conclusion that I drew from Afghanistan was not that it's all over for the Americans, but that they will start to focus and concentrate on what they do care about. Hence, I think, this warning. So that's the sort of macro picture. On the ground, I looked at who's moving what where. The Americans have put two warships into the Black Sea, which has really annoyed. It's international waters, but it's really annoyed the Russians. I'm not sure if the Brits have got one there or not. The British, as the newspapers have, it was in the Sun, the Mail, the Times today, the British reconnaissance plane did go quite close to Russian airspace. It was 30 miles, international airspace. It's allowed to be there. Russians put up a fighter jet. It went away. And it is a spy plane. There's no question about it. It finds electronic signals and it can work out where they've come from and try and decode them. And it's a spy plane, no question. More interestingly, what's happening on the Russian side, the 9,000 to 10,000 troops they're putting up near the Ukrainian border are proper fighting combat troops. And then I looked even closer at it. Some of them are from the 1st Guards Tank Army. The 1st Guards are usually up above near where Belarus comes down towards Lithuania and Poland, that little gap there that separates Kaliningrad from Belarus. They're usually up there, and it's called the Smolensk Gate. The 1st Army's up there. Well, they've moved down, that's almost 500 kilometres. What is that tank unit doing down there? I don't know. They're an exercise. They're allowed. It's part of Russia. But it's just sort of, that's different. The language from the Americans, they've stated that our security guarantee to Ukraine is ironclad. That's a pretty strong word. You know, it's messaging. And then the story you've got, Ian, for Reaction, that the Brits, it looks like next week, are going to beef up the defence cooperation. Mm-hmm. Now, that's your story. My understanding of what it might be about could be extra surface-to-surface missiles.
I don't know
the detail, but that makes sense. And possibly there might be something. There's already a naval agreement. I mean, we are not a treaty ally that has to come to their defense. They're not in NATO. But it does seem from your story that the ties are about to get closer. And why now? And I think we know why now. It's messaging to say we will push back if you do what may or may not happen.
And I think there's frustration that you know the Ukrainians are really pretty pretty isolated and feeling it, and with the EU preoccupied with the Belarus situation and the EU unprepared to be too tough on Putin for reasons that we understand, because Germany effectively without a government at the moment is in a position where it relies on Russian gas and then the alternative.
And who did Putin call 2 or 3 days ago? Merkel. That was the phone call. He picked up the phone for Germany. And you're right, they are a bit of a weak link in a robust response to that. The Baltic states want more of a robust response. You know, nobody wants war, but they don't want to invite on aggression. And then this is, again, going back to this thing about post-Afghanistan, without question, the Chinese and the Russians will prod and push. I would if I was them. You know, I'm not condemning them necessarily for their actions. They're entirely logical.
Yeah. And you've got a situation which is the timing could not be more perfect for Putin, because you've got that German political situation which I described, where it's essentially German politics is frozen as they try and form a new coalition and they move to the post-Merkel era and don't necessarily want a fight with Russia. Then the situation with France, which is also weird because the Russian-French relations have always been an interesting subject, but that President Macron takes a very particular view that the long-term future is a rapprochement, a good working relationship with Russia, that Russia is a serious European power. You have to take it seriously and you can't view it in narrowly Cold War terms. So to the Ukrainians, that means you can't look for any serious help to the EU or to Germany or France. So your options then are, as you described, Tim, the US, but also the UK, which has been since 2016 forging closer defence links. And I think my understanding of what's about to happen as early as next week is that there are two parts to it connected. Firstly, is some form of bolstering the existing defence pact and cooperation pact. Whether or not it offers guarantees, it's just something to signal that Britain is engaged and prepared to act in some way or prepared to defend Ukraine. And then the second is some form of arms deal or additional military support. There's also a complication of one cause that Putin might use is this argument, I think headed through the Ukrainian courts about debts which the Russians say the Ukrainians owe to Russia, but the Ukrainians say, well, that was a previous government and it was extracted almost under duress. It was a kind of hostage style situation. So there's that excuse which Putin has. So if he's thinking in terms of timing, there's a lot lined up, which if he really does want to act and he has problems at home, then there's potential there. So I think that is what's particularly worrying the British and the Americans. And the Americans growing, I understand, increasingly exasperated with the European Union and Europe's failure to lead. And that talks again to your Bosnia piece, Tim, where you made the point that these things happen and then afterwards you get some grandstanding from countries that won't spend their foreign ministers make grand speeches about the common European defence interests and the common European home, but it's too late by then.
Which is what happened in 91 when it was clear Yugoslavia was falling apart. Jacques Poux, the Luxembourg foreign prime minister, who was a big player in the EU, was saying the hour of Europe has arrived. And it was Jacques Delors who told the Americans we wouldn't interfere in your area, and we think you should respect not interfering in ours. In other words, don't worry, we're going to sort Yugoslavia out. And then 100,000 deaths later, it took the Americans coming in to stop it. Ditto more or less Bosnia, Kosovo as well. Yeah. Sorry, let me try and bring a whole bunch of stuff together based on what you just said. I mean, Putin has given them in Bosnia thousands of rifles. He's met the president of Republika Srpska, I think, 5 or 6 times in the last 6 or 7 years. This is a little area which is, the population is smaller than Yorkshire. You know, Putin doesn't go and meet the mayor of Leeds once a year. You know, there's a reason why he's putting it, because he does not want Bosnia in NATO, which could be a long-term deal. And lots of other reasons that he's playing, he's involving himself, and there is a risk of violence. You mentioned Macron. Now, Macron's right. You should try to have a rapprochement with Russia. And mistakes have been made in the past, including the manner of the advancing of NATO up to Russia's borders. Mm-hmm. There were hybrid ways of doing that, of getting, because the populations of these countries voted in governments that said, we want to join NATO. You know, that's democracy. So I'm not saying that they shouldn't have come into NATO, but there could have been a more gentle way where, yes, you can be in NATO, but we say we're not going to put any foreign troops or American hardware on your territory for 10 years. You're still in NATO. You still got the Article 5 guarantee. So it could have been done differently. So Macron's right. But where I think he's wrong is that if you find naked aggression, which we have found, and you know, poisoning people on other people's soil and all the other things that Russia does under Putin, you have to push back, because if you don't, you're just saying, please, could you beat us again, could you, with a big stick? And the Baltics know that, the Poles know that, but the two big countries, France and Germany, notably Germany, don't. And yeah, Biden is absolutely fed up with it. And it's part of that even bigger divide of the Americans saying across the world, can you please do some more here? Because we need to do some more over here. And if you want to decouple Europe from America, then don't take care of issues in your own backyard. And at the moment, we're not.
Yeah. So I want to next highlight a story from The Economist, which I think we probably going to critique or even criticize. I have to say I'm back reading The Economist regularly and enjoying it, actually, after a long period where I wasn't, or sort of lost the habit. Sure, that's polite enough, isn't it? Lost the habit during the whole Brexit wars. But there's a piece on the Belarus situation which is headlined, "A scheme to use migrants to split the EU is likely to backfire." I think it's the reason I highlighted is I think it's a slightly quixotic and unusual
backfire on Belarus, you mean?
Well, yeah. So it's saying that saying it's overdone, this idea of Alexander Lukashenko, of course, the leader of Putin-backed leader of Belarus, the idea that he's some master tactician. And you should explain, Tim, what he's doing on the border, the way he's exploiting the border and what he's doing with...
I think he's a tactician. I'm not sure he's a strategist. I mean, I've always argued that Putin is both. Lukashenko looks more like, one crisis to the next. Yeah, sorry. Sorry.
Yeah, the contention is that that the EU is toughening up its position, and that Merkel, which is true, has asked Russia's president to talk Mr. Lukashenko out of his plotting. The EU's hinting at fresh sanctions.
Why would he do that?
Well, as they say, her success chances of success seem slim. But I just think it's a slightly unusual take in that he's in a very strong position, because he has this enormous thing next door called Russia, which is clearly intimately involved in the policy that he's prosecuting, and in an EU which, as we've just described, is divided.
There's already sanctions on Belarus because of the election that he allegedly stole last year, and the brutal manner in which he put down the opposition, and lots of other things. It is clear, incontrovertible, surely, that Well, we know he's given thousands and thousands of visas to desperate people from other parts of the world, flown them in to Minsk, stuck them on buses and put them up to the border both of Lithuania and Poland, and then started to push them across to try and cause a crisis, and he has. I don't necessarily think that Putin rang him up and told him to do it, but Putin's quite happy, you know, to see the EU in as much turmoil as possible. Completely suits him. And I'm trying to connect it back to Ukraine, but by the way, Ukraine has moved 8,500 border police and National Guard up to the Belarus border because a lot of the border of Ukraine and Belarus, it's very sort of swampy fields, forests. You know, it's not a hard border that you can patrol. They've relied on the terrain. But of course, people are so desperate, they may try and come through that terrain. So it's not a good thing having all these thousands and thousands of people with guns moving around. You know, you've got the Belarus and the Russians on military exercises. You've got the Russians moving down to the Ukraine border. You've got the Ukrainians on alert on their border. You've got the Ukrainians moving eight. This is you know, not a good thing. Sorry, but to this piece, which I haven't read, but if you know, if the contention is that this could backfire, What's to backfire on Lukashenko? Will he be even further isolated from the people he's completely isolated from already? If that's possible, yes. More sanctions? Maybe. And the people of Belarus are suffering. But I remember the people of Iraq suffering for about 15 years under Saddam and sanctions. So is that how long we're going to give it? Who's got the bigger cards to play here? Well, 20% of Europe's gas, I think it is, it might just be Germany's, one of the two, comes through the pipelines that come from Belarus. And he's saying, I might turn those off. And it is getting a bit cold. Also, I might turn this tap of people on even more. So yeah. I just think that those two cards are probably better cards at the moment than anything the EU has.
And also moving into winter.
Yeah.
The winter hasn't properly
and started. More people are going to die. And the Poles are damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. If they do something about it and open the door, they may open the floodgates. And then the population, which already is very concerned about this, may turn against the government. And if they don't, if they beat them back, they are universally condemned for brutality. And again, this is something that, you know, they've worked this out in Minsk and Moscow. It's lose-lose on this side of the border.
So I'm talking to Tim Marshall, reaction columnist and author, who's just showing again, he's absolutely right, how maps and geography really matter. If you're not familiar with his books, you certainly should be. Prisoners of Geography,
thank you.
The Power of Geography. And links to those below.
Ian, you're the editor, but let me ask you a question about a faraway country about which I know little. Whitehall and British politics.
Well,
because
I
know you've picked out. Is it the Spectator?
Yeah. Yes, I have.
Yeah.
I have. I just have one thing to flag.
Oh, beg your pardon.
No, it's okay. I'm going to put the link in below. But just in these sort of situations, I always find myself every day reading the stuff that comes through TASS. Which is a named country with, for those of us old enough to remember, the Cold War.
Nah, comrade.
And it's the way to see how things are reported.
Oh, I do this a lot. If I want to know what the Kremlin, not what their, you know, deep strategy is, there's no secrets. But if you watch Russia Today, which comes straight out of the Kremlin, you start to see what their take on it is, and you can see through it. What the Kremlin is wants the take, and you can do it with
the report this morning, very very intriguing in that it presents what's happening on the border with Ukraine as NATO aggression, obviously, and the business over the spy plane refueling. NATO so presents NATO as a sort of warmongers spoiling for a fight, and
I have a tiny bit of sympathy in for that. I don't think we're aggressive. I don't think we're about to invade Russia. I don't think we're any threat to Russia. But I do understand where that comes from. It comes from a Russian psyche of a knowledge of history, of looking that way. And the Swedes came that way and invaded. The Poles invaded them. Napoleon invaded them. The Germans invaded them twice. Yeah. They say there was an agreement NATO wouldn't come up. It has done. So I don't excuse, you know, the actions of the leadership of Russia, but I do understand that mindset and how easy it is to sell to your population who have that collective memory of those moments.
Well, that's what makes me wonder if there. That's what Tim. That's what makes me wonder if there is something bigger at play here, because, you know, as Putin, you said he's a tactician and a strategist.
Mm.
Is there a? He's obviously got some domestic problems at the moment, and a war or some kind of conflict, something just short of it, can sometimes be the solution for an autocrat. Do you think there's a big plan of his to essentially, whether it's to incorporate Belarus, take most of Ukraine, create something which he can retire at some point, eventually having recreated.
He'll never retire.
Something like the Soviet Union.
Yes. But that doesn't mean he will do it. I mean, there is what you want and what you can have. So without question, if he could do X, Y, and Z, yeah, he would. Who wouldn't? And it is very roughly as follows. Push back against the Chinese influence in the Central Asian republics to make sure that you're the biggest influence there in your near abroad, as they call it. But looking westwards, get the Baltic states back on side one way or another. That's a real priority. 100% make sure that there is a friendly president in Belarus. Doesn't have to be Lukashenko. He doesn't actually like Lukashenko, apparently. He dislikes him at a personal level. And the moment he's no longer useful to him, he's quite happy to have him thrown out as long as there's another pro-Moscow guy in.
Imagine Vladimir Putin regarding you as unlikable and too vulgar.
So to maintain your buffer between you and these people that used to invade you, which I don't think is a threat anymore, but... And Ukraine, another massive, massive part of this buffer. So what is achievable? If there is complete nothingness coming out of the Europeans and the Americans, then you could incorporate the Baltic states. I think that's too big a gamble, Article 5 NATO. Belarus, in the event that there was a revolution such as in Ukraine, it looked like that it would flip. I think the Russian troops will cross the border and come to the Polish border. And at that point, you will amalgamate the two countries. He's already moved to, you know, make them not an entity, but very deep connections. And there's ethnic Russians in Belarus, and the Russian constitution under him has been changed to say that they have a duty to protect them. Ditto in Ukraine. On Ukraine, militarily, you could probably get to the river in Kiev in about 3 days. You know, they're big enough and good enough if they wanted to gamble that much and then have a protracted guerrilla war for decades, which they don't. So you'd like to do it, but you probably won't. But what is achievable, again, if there's no pushback, you probably know the Donbass region. That's the bit that the separatists, mostly ethnic Russians, took from Ukraine. It borders Russia, so there is that bit of buffer zone that Russia has now, and the rest of Ukraine remains Ukrainian, except for Crimea and the port of Sebastopol, which was essentially invaded and annexed, not recognized by hardly anybody. Well, again, look at the map and you'll see that the Donbass region, which is now under pro-Russian control, and Crimea, which is under Russian control, is separated only by about 100 miles of the coastline of the Sea of Azov and the port of Mariupol. If he really did go for it, if this buildup is real, if they cross the border, the temptation to race down and join Donbass via Mariupol to the Crimea might be too much to resist. End of stage one, very briefly. Stage two, in another few years, if and this is just about what you might want to do, not what you will do. You can race up the coast of the Black Sea to Odessa, which is a majority Russian-speaking port and you can join the whole lot up to Odessa. 20 years time, well, let's go up to Moldova, Transnistria, where 2,000 Russian troops hold out in Transnistria, part of Moldova. Now I've got the whole of that curve, and I'm feeling a lot better in Moscow now, a lot more comfortable. So, you know, I think there is a big idea, but lots of us can have big ideas, but you can't always carry them out.
Fascinating. You're watching Reaction on YouTube. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, you just click the subscribe button below. And if you want to become a member of Reaction, go to the link below to the main site and you get my weekly newsletter, Tim's column, and lots of other great stuff from the Reaction team. Tim, I interrupted you and you were going to ask me a question.
I just wanted you to
a small country or a small place of which you know.
A faraway hall, which appears to be white, about which I know little. I'm aware of the Spectator front page, Court of Chaos. I do follow British politics, but not the way that you do.
Yeah.
And I'm aware that I thought up until now that Johnson, what appears to be Johnson's thinking, is that we can bulldoze our way through this and sort of ruffle our hair a bit and go like that, and it will go away. And he's been right almost every time. Mm. But, I might as well hold it up. Other magazines are available. And I do get other magazines, I hasten to add.
It's a great cover. As I said to someone from the Spectator this week, it's amazing how much better the covers are compared to Boris's day. I mean, it's a brilliant.
Yeah, it's got that. Is it Ancien Régime and the fin de siècle and let them eat cake and the masses I don't care because there's Jacob. You know, there's a lot going on there, and I haven't read it yet, but my understanding is it's a court of chaos, but is the idea, and do you agree with this, that actually this chaos is catching up with them now and actually could do for them in the long term?
I think it is, and it could. The piece is written by Fraser Nelson, obviously the editor of the Spectator. It's a really good read, and it gets to the heart of the psychology of what's going on. And Boris is essentially, you know, he's surrounded, as the piece says, by courtiers. And I mean, there are some good people in there as well. But he's at that phase, always dangerous for leaders, where he doesn't like to hear no.
It took Blair two terms before he fell victim to, you know, knowing everything.
Yeah, and you just fall victim to this idea that those who are putting up obstacles, or you start to see even people asking questions as oppositionalism, as somehow they're not with the program, and that's a consequence of happens to most leaders eventually. But that's just being prime minister is very draining, and is very hard work, even for someone like Boris, who has an unusual approach to the job. It is really tough. So when people raise their hand and say maybe that won't work, or maybe X is not a good idea because Y will happen, you just think, well, come on, you're just an irritant. You're kind of getting in the way. And it's on that basis that the Paterson disaster happened, which is the decision by the Prime Minister. And it was his decision, not the Chief Whip's decision. It's been made clear at Westminster
to charge ahead. What happens to intelligent people? Because, you know, the guy clearly super bright. When I was in full-time journalism in the newsroom is not a democracy. You know, it is a form of dictatorship because the editor has the final say and you can go with that or not. I used to take the approach that if on not many occasions, if I disagreed with the editor and was asked for my opinion, I would quite happily say, look, I actually think, we shouldn't be doing this and we should be doing this and here's why. But then making it clear so I didn't get fired. However, if we're going to go down that way, I am part of a team and I will then follow it and do it. Mm-hmm. But I'm not frightened to say, I actually think this is wrong. And I can't see why an intelligent leader wouldn't want people like that and wouldn't actually know that they could get themselves boxed into their kitchen cabinet and their little world. But it does seem to happen over and over again.
But that's why, that's originally one of the reasons he did, you know, he did have Cummings.
And yeah.
To a lesser extent, Lee Kane running the press and communications side. But they were prepared to say no to him, and much more than no, actually. So he ended up feeling that they were, so it is said, that they were running him, and that they thought that they were, that Dom thought that he was running the government. And
yeah, but there were those rumours that actually they were actually trying to undermine him behind the back. Whereas, you know, my approach is that you make your peace and you say, okay, I'll now get behind this. So I can understand if people are pushed out, if they're actually trying to undermine. But I mean, I don't know the inner staff the way you do. There's only one person that I'm actually familiar with, and he's a brilliant mind, and I'm very confident would not be supine in the face of idiocy. Mm. But is that what's happening?
There are a few, but also remember that the way that Number 10 works, the way that the government works, is it is a rolling machine where, and you don't have to accept Dom Cummings' critique of, and you're right, actually. He admits now in his writings on his Substack that they were trying to undermine the Prime Minister, or they were trying to sideline the Prime Minister so that, as he saw it, sensible people could get on with taking decisions. A bizarre position in a democracy, and very very dangerous.
What is he, Rasputin now? Yeah.
There is this part of the job of the civil service, as it sees it, and the establishment machine, is to try and just carry on the business of government, so that business is transacted, and it's transacted by various meetings, memos, bits of paper, boxes, and for a cabinet secretary and senior officials, they don't want sort of, you know, punch-ups in Number 10 or arguments or disagreement. They want the thing to flow smoothly, particularly when you have a prime minister like this prime minister, who can be quite erratic or capricious, or make a sudden decision like the one he made on Paterson, where he just decided effectively to just sort of tear the plaster off and just say, right, okay, not only defend Owen Paterson, try and change the rules that govern the standards regime. A complete disaster. Where I think the real damage is done, so it's two parts to it. There's the public perception, don't know yet, and it's the most kind of boring thing that people say about politics at the moment, and I think, you know, it's really cynical, is it's all priced in, none of it really matters, because everyone knows that Boris is a controversial character who makes mistakes.
No.
I just don't, I think...
No, there's limits to that.
Yeah, long term, you can't really defy political gravity, and this government is half the way through its term.
Right. I read your column in The Times yesterday, which is alluding to this. Was it William Hague who's had a piece as well this week? I mean, is the conservative press, is there a real klaxon coming from it about this?
Yeah, I think yes, there is. I mean, it shouldn't be overstated. The government is not about to fall.
No.
But what's just happened has, I think, a couple of very, very big policy implications. But what's happened in Parliament, so there's the public side of things, and then I think what really matters is the impact on the Tory parliamentary party.
Oh, aye, you were writing yesterday, weren't you, that they're muttering, you know what, I'm checking everything these guys are doing because I don't want to get thrown under the bus and they look like a fool.
Yeah. And if you're an MP, you're now on the, and you're in a relatively marginal seat, or even a seat with 4,000 or 5,000 majority, you're thinking, you're now starting to think, right, when's the general election? What's my opponent going to say on their leaflets? What am I vulnerable to? Mm. You're watching the sort of local, you know, local coverage. And so you just have to be very careful that you're not set up in the way that they were, they feel that they were betrayed and over the past.
This is a press review, Ian. So, I mean, I've got my head stuck usually in some subscription website from some obscure think tank. And I don't actually look across the media the way you do. You've said that there is something of a klaxon, and the Tory MPs are obviously reading it, if so. Does the inner circle in Downing Street look at this array of media and the headlines and you know, whatever's going on in Sky and News at 10 or whatever? Can they really just do this bluster, the Boris bluster, and just push through it? Or don't they have to course correct and say, and does he look at all this stuff? Has he got time? I mean, I know that they live their lives in 15-minute chunks at that level.
I think so. Yeah, as I understand it, he reads a lot. They thought that they were doing, in media terms, they thought that they were doing quite well until this Paterson thing happened, and that he'd had a good press out of COP, which generally he had that launch weekend. Biden looked irrelevant.
I'm not convinced about the headlines this weekend on COP, but we'll see.
We'll see. But the story they had told themselves was that they'd actually had pretty good coverage and it had gone relatively well at the launch. I just think that the impact of those Tory MPs thinking, hold on, what am I voting for here? Do this lot know what they're doing? One big consequence of that, which I don't think has yet played out, but which will play out in the press in the next few weeks, is the impact on the Article 16 negotiations and debate. Because I think you have to pose the question.
So it's Northern Ireland.
At the moment.
Oh, that's coming up fast, yeah.
Yeah, the Brits are embroiled in a debate with the European Union about renegotiating the Northern Ireland Protocol. Now, until now, Number 10 and the Brexit team led by David Frost have been able to assume, well, they've got a majority of 80, they can kind of do whatever they want. But I think if you look at the dynamics now of Parliament and what went wrong over the Paterson business, even a majority of 80, I mean, their majority was slashed to 13 on that vote, I think. You don't need to lose a vote.
Yeah,
there could be a debate after you've issued the statutory instrument saying that's it, triggering Article 16. What if the Lords does something? What if respected MPs like Greg Clark or others say, hold on a minute, how long is this trade war with France lasting for? What are the terms on which it's going to be finished?
Well, there's also a number of Tories who hold what I hope is not an old-fashioned view, that a country does stick by its international agreements. Otherwise, it is known on the international stage as being untrustworthy.
That's crazy. Could that catch on? That idea? But yes, so I think it does limit their freedom of manoeuvre. It's interesting. Frost has moved back to trying to be the Times. Bruno Waterfield reported this morning has moved back to being slightly more conciliatory and saying wants to do a deal with the EU because
they've offered concessions.
Does it have the numbers for a trade war to sustain a trade war for the next year at a time when inflation's rising, all sorts of stresses and strains? I'm not sure the Treasury would put up with it either.
Going back to press again, I'm very conscious it's, you know, press review, but whenever I watch the press reviews on telly, I think that isn't a press review. That's just a headline, and then you're talking about your opinion. Whereas I actually like it if someone can say, yeah, they've put it on page 3, and this journalist here is, they, you know, just tell me something, and pull back the curtain a little bit about... Yeah. Anyway, what was I going to say?
Well, I'm just... You're making me feel guilty because you're absolutely right, Tim, and we're
trying... Well, no, I didn't mean you, week. Editor. No, just let me finish the point, sorry. When it came to fish and France, I think you can get away with a few sort of headlines, because bashing the French, you know, you've got a reasonably large constituency in the UK. That I think when you're messing with people's lives, potentially life and death issue of Northern Ireland, I think that the headlines will be less forgiving, even if it is a row with France, which essentially it is, because at the base of it is Macron's view of strategic autonomy via the EU, vis-a-vis not having to, you know, having their own foreign policy, and those Anglo-Saxons that are kowtowing to the Americans and trying to get out into the deep blue ocean, they cannot do that, because you have to show that if you leave the EU, you get punished, which is part of the French, but you know, it's a French, the fish row, but it is about that much bigger picture. And I think the headlines when it comes to Northern Ireland will be more sceptical.
But also track what the Sun and the Mail are doing. But both were very...
Ambassadors used to say to me after we finished the Ferrero Russia, they used to say, especially new ones, not, you know, I wasn't, you know, best buddies with every single ambassador, but occasionally a new one, if I did meet them, would say, what do you think I should read? And I'd go through a whole bunch of stuff about me. And then I'd say, and I think you should read The Sun Says. What? This tabloid? Yeah, I think you should A, read The Sun, but also read The Sun Says.
Agreed.
Because, well, for various reasons that you understand about how important it is and how that Downing Street looks at it, and actually it does hold a bit of sway, not as much in the fractured media we have. And then they were always astonished. But yeah, I think it still holds. Have a look
Sun,
at what's...
Sun, yeah, so The Sun is being very, very aggressive and robust, and is a must read on the government. The Mail similarly. Just wanted to flag up that piece from Bruno Waterfield and Oliver Wright, which is in the Times on Friday. We want a deal on Northern Ireland Protocol. Frost tells EU in bid to calm tension. So they are moving, as Bruno and Oliver explained. They're moving to try and take the heat out of it. I think, you know, you might, if you were a conspiracy theorist, you'd say, well, surely a trade war triggering Article 16, scrapping the protocol, tariffs, France, all the rest of it. Well, that is that means that papers like The Sun and the Mail would then be back on side. So it's a solution to a problem. It's not, because a trade war could last for quite a long time. Be extremely messy would be the concern. And I think the thing that the thing to watch out for is, If they do go for it on Article 16, I'm not convinced that they will. Mm-hmm. I think they'll carry on negotiating. Then Brexit is undone. Now, Britain's then outside the European Union. But the Brexit deal, which was said to be oven ready and the greatest deal ever, and the basis on which the 2019 general election was fought, is null and void. That deal's a goner. And you're into an open-ended and potentially expensive trade war. So I don't think they have quite as much room for manoeuvre as they think.
I mean, that is, I agree with you on the economics of that. And then, as I understand it, there is then a hard border on the island of Ireland. And at that point, you are risking, you know, I mean, there's already violence. It's never really completely gone away, but you could see it come back. And
But the British wouldn't impose it, but then it would create create a dilemma for the European Union, but we'll see. So thank you very much for joining me, Tim Marshall.
Thank you.
This special edition of Press Review. As Tim says, you know, we wandered off hopefully in a very interesting direction into discussing all manner of things related to geopolitics and politics. But at the heart of it, Press Review is a program where we highlight the stories and coverage, columnists, sometimes podcasts as well, things that have grabbed our attention in the last week or so. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. And until next time, thank you very much for watching and listening. That was Press Review, our weekly show. This is the Reaction podcast with me, Ian Martin. If you're not a Reaction member, click on the link below, visit our site and sign up. Until next time, thank you for listening.